Welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast, hosted by DSI. I'm Zach Fagan, and today we have the iconic Aaron Dresbin from Peak Projects. Aaron, thank you very much for coming in. Appreciate
you
joining us.
Great to see you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we've talked a little bit offline about Peak a little bit. Tell me a bit more how you got into the business, into the construction and project management business.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting. You see a lot of people come into construction management and owner's representation from, you know, the construction industry, XGCs, people who, have been in the field for a number of years. I myself came from the architecture world. I was an architect, practiced in New York for a number of years on some pretty amazing projects, Billionaires Row towers, very high-end, high-touch finishes. And that experience really shaped my early understanding of what high-end projects looked like and some extremely complex projects in terms of construction logistics, execution, and big teams, really being able to work within an environment where there's a lot of competing forces, whether they're schedule, financial, design-based, and you really needed to collaborate to be able to pull off pretty incredible things. So That's where I got my start. And then I ended up moving back to LA, where I was born and raised, and worked for a design build, the prominent firm Marmorad Zehner, and doing a lot of really interesting design build projects, both on some spec projects and also on some custom design build residences, where I really got to cut my teeth a little bit more on the construction side and see some opportunities of how we can collaborate better and really work to bring the owner to the table and educate them and make good decisions.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. Very cool. So that experience in architecture has probably helped quite a bit inform the way that you do things today, for sure.
Yeah. One of the things I think is really a benefit from the training that you get in architecture as a project manager and owner's rep is when you're in architecture school, oftentimes you have to stand up in front of a group of critics who can be pretty tough on you and present some information in a clear and concise way. And that's oftentimes what we do with our clients is we're given 5, 10, 15 minutes to download, you know, a huge amount of information and help them make actionable decisions. And so that kind of early training in architecture school and giving presentations is a big part of, I think, what we do as owner's reps.
Yeah, for sure. Very cool. So what part of LA did you grow up in?
I actually grew up in Studio City.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. My parents are still in the same ranch house, and it's, you know, been great to be able to continue my career here. And really, I think so much has changed since I was a kid in LA. We've really matured into a city that is more interested in density, that's really, I think kind of become something that is really on the map globally in terms of arts and culture in a way that it maybe wasn't back in the day. And I think just seeing the development also in new industries, new spaces has been great. I think as far as design and construction, there's probably not many better places to be in the world. There's just such a variety and so many interesting projects going on. One of the things that drove me back here as an architect too is the ability to do really fun ground up projects, you know, as opposed to New York, where you're doing a lot of, you know, interior architecture. You don't get to express yourself creatively as much. It's really fun to be able to do out of the box things here.
Right. Yeah. You mean doing projects in high rises where you don't have any control over the facade or the entry or any of that stuff. It's just really interior stuff. You have a box to work within, and that's kind of it. Yeah. Interesting.
Not to mention the stylistic diversity, right? You get everything from really traditional historical styles to, you know, Frank Gehry projects. So
sure.
And seeing those side by side is so much fun.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I used to live off of Troost, and now I live off of Colfax. It's right next to CBS. So Studio City is that's my jam. So you grew up in LA, got your master's degree in architecture at Yale. how do the kind of West Coast, you know, and, you know, East Coast experiences combine for you?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. You know, I joke around a little bit with my colleagues out in New York. Peak is a national company, so we get really the benefits of being able to see how clients act, you know, on both coasts, see how projects develop and culture, building culture is really different in different places. You know, we joke around that in New York, the meetings start 5 minutes before they're supposed to. And in LA, you know, people get stuck in traffic and they start, you know, 10, 15 minutes after right. they're supposed to. So yes. there's a little bit of that. But I think for me, you know, having the rigor of these large, complex commercial style projects on the East Coast really helped cut my teeth in a way and bring that rigor to West Coast projects. You know, I think there tends to be maybe a bit more casual attitude. And, you know, that can be a good thing, but that also can be a struggle on projects where there's really tight schedule and budget demands and making sure that as a team, we're accountable to the client's goals. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it. But again, the West Coast creativity is really refreshing. And sometimes you need to give the design team a little bit of creative breathing room to be able to come up with some outstanding solutions. Yeah, so.
For sure. Very cool. Very cool. So in your role, you know, leading these kind of large scale, you know, luxury resi projects, what trends or shifts, you know, are you really seeing in, you know, kind of luxury home design and client priorities right now?
Yeah. I think the biggest things that I have really seen over the past couple of years is a huge trend in wellness.
Ah.
So, you know, we were joking around a little bit before about screening rooms, theaters, which there was a time in LA where every new luxury single family home had an amazing screening room, which was probably great for DSI's business. We see a lot less of that, frankly. Things have changed a little bit. Those rooms are more of a multifunctional space that might have a golf sim in them, but they're also more social spaces, and wellness has become a huge component in them too. So we're seeing a lot of spas, a lot of saunas, a lot of concerns about indoor air quality, water filtration, smart home more generally. So that's one trend that I see a lot of. And then the other thing is privacy and security. Mm-hmm. So privacy and security in the data networks, safe rooms, entry access systems, things that really make people feel safe. This also comes to, you know, fire suppression systems, things that people can use to remotely monitor their homes, energy systems. So I would say there's a big tech focus, but that's related to the privacy and security space.
Interesting. So on the kind of energy side, what are some trends that you're seeing with regard to, or I guess let me rephrase, are you seeing a trend toward a proper energy management and battery backup system to the extent that the systems that are going in are big enough to not only maintain the technology experience, but also all the safety and, you know, just everything that runs on electricity in the house, a whole house backup system. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, we do see a lot of that. You know, it's always a question early on with a client of what their priorities are, you know, how long they anticipate being in the house during an outage, right? And part of it, as we start to see LADWP or Edison shutting off electricity and high wind events more and more, you know, you have to be able to plan around that. So right. just looking at the average duration for an outage, trying to understand what their needs are. Is it primarily about life safety and systems, or is it about, hey, I'm entertaining and I don't want to have a disruption to my dinner party? So kind of getting clients' goals around that, and then building a system around them that really works. Mm. So I'd say it's a bit of a mix. We try to make smart decisions, and you don't want to overbuild if you're not going to use the house in that way. But
for
there's
sure.
certain like life safety systems and, you know, other critical infrastructure that's kind of unquestionable. You want to have that backed up.
Right. Magnetic door locks, surveillance systems, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Are there any other kind of technologies or, you know, sustainability features or anything that you're seeing that customers are especially interested in?
You know, it's really interesting. I think there was a time when putting solar panels on your roof was considered like, hey, I'm being really sustainable and eco-friendly. And now it's not only is it mandated by code, but it's just so expected. So a lot of those kinds of sustainability features are absolutely part of projects. Everyone's particular needs, I think, really vary on that front. It's so cool to see a whole new variety of products, especially in the wake of the fires, come out that both have a sustainable aspect and a fire resiliency aspect incorporated in them. And I think when you think about sustainability more broadly, thinking about resiliency as a huge part of that, you know, we want to make sure these houses last not for, you know, 5-10 years, but can really be part of a solution of building quality for the next generation, right? That is real sustainability. Yeah, so it's not always about kind of what's green or greenwashed, but what's really sustainable.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the essence of sustainability is the thing that endures over a long period of time, right? And doesn't need to be, you know, rebuilt or remodeled, right, over and over again.
Discover why we're the most awarded home technology firm in the U.S. Our design-centric approach transforms your space with effortless control of lighting, motorized shades, audio, video, and more. Our friendly experts guide you every step of the way, no tech speak, just smart, stunning simplicity. We provide years of care from our award-winning service and support team. Experience technology that feels as good as it looks.
I know you've done tons and tons of projects over the years, and it's probably hard to, you know, pick one to say, you know, that one was my favorite, right? Or that client was my favorite one. But is there any particular project that you're especially proud of?
You're asking me to choose like a favorite child here. You know, they all have different aspects that have been really interesting. Sometimes it can be, for me, as interesting as, you know, a complex contract negotiation that was really hard to get to the finish line. I've had plenty of those. And when you come out of that experience and get everyone to align, it's really a special thing because that means we're all on a good footing to move forward together.
Right.
But if I had to pick one, you know, I had the opportunity to work on an amazing project in Bel Air with Marmol Radziner that is truly spectacular with an amazing cantilevered pool. You know, it's had really interesting artisans work from Mexico that was brought in, amazing tile work, amazing stone work. And there was a lot of complexity in that project, several different lighting designers involved in specific spaces, and just a lot of technical challenges with hillside retaining walls and lots of piles in the ground. So that would probably be one of the top experiences on the residential side.
Wow, very cool. I mean, cantilevered pool, that's not a combination of words that I've put together in a while. I can imagine there was, you know, quite a bit of engineering involved to pull that off. So kind of shifting, you know, over to the Palisades, when you think about rebuilding homes in, you know, fire-prone areas like the Palisades, what kind of, you know, design principles do you think are really most important?
You know, one of the things that's really interesting is there's so many different ways to approach resiliency and especially with wildfire, right? There's so much good information that's coming out about this right now, whether it's from a landscape perspective, from a materials perspective. The biggest thing that I think as a larger community that we need to think more about is development patterns and urban development patterns. And I think on the scale of individual single family homes, it's really hard to address that problem, but it comes from more of a community aspect. And as we start to think about how we're designing fire breaks for these communities and making sure that fire doesn't transfer from building to building as much, I think that's where more and more focus as a community And as a city, we need to think more about it from that side of things. It's a infrastructure problem, and it's a community design problem. Mm. So I think there's lots of different ways we can think about, hey, let's use a, you know, fire retardant exterior envelope, but there's also other ways to think about how we're incorporating fire breaks, pocket parks, things like that, that really help make sure that this doesn't move from block to block to block.
Yeah. No. So from a resiliency perspective, I mean, all of these factors work together, really. So in addition to, you know, fire hardening, how do, you know, kind of sustainability and, you know, climate resilience play into the rebuilding efforts?
Yeah, I think, you know, the sustainability side of things, we should really start to think about how we can incorporate things like oak trees to help catch embers, things like landscape design more holistically. When we look at, for example, the Case Study 2.0 program, like thinking more about how, not only how we design a beautiful house, but how do we design a beautiful landscape that is resilient to wildfires, but that's also aesthetically pleasing.
Right.
So I think the landscape component is huge and deserves a lot of thought and effort. I think as far as the technology side and how we start thinking about smart systems, you know, everyone seemed to find out about Watch Duty. No one knew about it in 2024. And then
now everyone does.
Everyone's got it on their phone, and there's so much that we can do through technology to make sure that people are aware of the risks and are using smart technology to deploy, you know, systems like fire sprinklers or other, you know, fire retardant systems that can help delay the progress of fires. So I think there's a lot of different ways that technology can be part of the solution.
Yeah, no doubt. We've talked to several case study architect participants, and there's been discussions about, you know, using the pool as a water reservoir, you know, and just kind of making that a standard, right? To the extent that when the fire department shows up, you got a pool, you've got a system already ready for them to just plug into and use. You know, obviously they can just suck water out of the pool, but there's conversations around like really kind of setting that up as another resource, right? You've got that body of water there, you know, use it. You can always fill the pool back up again later. And we've talked a bit as well about, you know, materials and stuff like that, but I like to, you know, at least pose the question, you know, other than the systems that we just talked about, are there any, you know, other new materials, you know, zero carbon solutions, low impact materials, or water saving designs, that you know about that you're kind of presenting or are otherwise, you know, trying to incorporate into your projects?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say systems like, you know, FosCheck or Frontline systems, we would propose them to clients a year ago and almost universally it was, oh, this is too expensive. Forget it. Let's move on. And now it seems like there's so much more knowledge out there about these systems, and the cost as a percentage of the project is so small that it's almost a no-brainer. Everyone says, absolutely, let's move forward. Of course, our partners at Frontline are saying, hey, we're backed up with sales for the next year or so, but
right.
That's where, you know, us having some pull and be able to get them out to a job site and deploy the system has been really helpful.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are really important, but that's kind of a last line of defense, right? You don't want to have to deploy those systems if you don't have to. And smart design principles are really, you know, number one. So, you know, we've had clients that are interested in, hey, what if we eliminate all of the wood framing from this house and use SIPS panels or use concrete or stone exterior? You know, that's one approach. But I think working with your design team is really the best approach. And then thinking about redundancy and what you can do if one system fails. Because inevitably, when something goes wrong, it's usually not one failure source. There's several things that happen. It's a combination of landscaping, what your neighbor has planted next to your property line, you know, what your backup power situation might be, and trying to figure out, okay, if this system fails, what other redundant system do I have in place to make sure that we're covered? So we see clients that have not only an electrical backup, you know, a battery, but they also have a diesel generator, right? And not only do they have a diesel generator, they also have a portable diesel generator. And so there's multiple layers just in case one of the systems fails.
How many projects are you working on in the Palisades? Do you have any rebuilds?
Yeah, so
that are happening now.
We've been working on about two projects right now. There, one of which was a fire rebuild, and then another one was an existing project in the Palisades that wasn't affected by the fires, but is, you know, our clients are now obviously very concerned about it. So we're taking some measures to make sure that they're not impacted in the future.
Yeah, gotcha. So, you know, on a practical level, after a home is, you know, lost to a fire, what are some of the, you know, kind of first recommendations that you make to a homeowner?
Yeah, I think the first recommendation I would make is to really take some time to think about what your project goals are. On every project that we do, we really start with a project charter, right? That goes through what the long-term and short-term goals are. How long are they comfortable being out of the house? How long are they covered by insurance? What's their all-in budget for the project? Mm. What are the quality goals? You know, do they have kids? Are the kids coming back to stay with them? How long do they anticipate being in the house? Those are the kinds of things that we really want to establish. Sustainability goals, technology goals, and that really helps set the stage. I think especially coming out of the fires where there's a lot of emotions that are still brewing, it's really good to take that time, write it all down so that you can come back to it later on and say, these are the decisions I made, and keep you on the right track moving forward.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great perspective. You know, another example, you know, how important might it be to, you know, immediately contact the insurance company, you know, secure the site, you know, bring in specialists, stuff like that?
Yeah, I think at this point, we've seen most people not only contact their insurance company, which really you need to do pretty immediately, certainly within the first 30 days to establish your claim. But most people have been paid out by their insurance companies. As far as building your team of specialists, you know, there's always a concern, hey, I want to make sure that I'm building my team and I've got the right team in place. And that is something that, you know, in an environment where there's only so many engineers, suppliers, et cetera, you want to do that within a time frame that makes sure that you're getting talent. But at the same point in time, there's not a huge rush. I think one thing that we've seen over the past several months is that given how much uncertainty there is, people are waiting a little bit on the sidelines and seeing what everyone else is going to do and who's going to be the first mover and who's going to take that risk. And I think that you will start to see kind of a bell curve of projects starting. We've already got a couple under construction now, right? But as far as active permits and how much construction has started, it's really just kind of a drop in the bucket.
Right.
I think once you start to see those first movers, it's really going to ramp up quite a bit. The risk of waiting too long is then there will certainly be a shortage of labor, subcontractors, and qualified GCs to really build these projects. So, you know, I think you don't necessarily want to be the guinea pig and be the first one, but at the same point in time, you don't want to wait so long that there's quite a bit of competition in the marketplace.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. What about, like, at what point should a homeowner, like, go ahead and contact, you know, an architect or, for example, a project management firm?
Yeah, I think that we love to see when our clients contact us as soon as possible when they're thinking about a project. We oftentimes are doing due diligence on a property. We're helping to put together a realistic budget and schedule for the project and giving them the tools to say, hey, this is something I want to move forward with or something I don't want to do. We've helped out a number of clients or prospective clients with potential rebuild projects, and they've looked at the numbers and the schedule and they said, hey, this doesn't make sense for us. We're going to sell the lot. We've had others who've been really excited about the prospect, and then they start moving to the next steps of engaging an architect. You know, the first part of building out your team is really probably, you know, after a project manager or owner's rep, is to move towards a surveyor. Sometimes you want to engage an engineer to understand what the soil composition is like, or if there's existing foundations, whether they're reusable, and then also an architect to help plan and design the home for you.
Yeah. Gotcha. You know, Peak has put a big focus on, you know, due diligence, risk mitigation, stuff like that. In rebuilding scenarios, what are some, you know, less obvious risks that, you know, you may be able to help homeowners uncover?
Yeah. You know, I think the biggest risk that we try to help with is vetting your team, making sure you have a really qualified group of people that are working for you, and that your contract structure and your incentives are set up to ensure a successful conclusion to your project, right? I think we've all heard horror stories of deposits being paid to a general contractor or subcontractor. They weren't qualified and they left town with your deposit. That is something that, you know, we are at the front of any project team selection to making sure that you've got a really good group of people that are tested, that have been through the paces, that maybe we've worked with before. If we haven't worked with them before, we're doing the requisite research to make sure that they have a really good track record. Yeah, and it's not just the name of the company, but it's the project manager, it's the site super, it's the project engineer that you're working with on a day-to-day basis to make sure that they have the capacity to really pull it off.
Yeah, no, it's super important. We haven't really seen any kind of, I don't know, skullduggery, I guess, as it were, so far with, you know, the aftermath of the fires. I hope that we don't. It, you know, I grew up in hurricane country, and there was always someone sniffing around trying to do just what you had described, where they kind of abscond with the deposit and don't do the work or do really crappy work and, you know, that type of thing. And it's, we were just talking about this yesterday about how it's really a testament to, you know, the culture of the design build community in Los Angeles, where like literally no one is seeing that. No one's doing it. Everyone stepped up. Then we're not complaining about it. And, you know, people are doing work pro bono. We're doing work pro bono. And we're not seeing that kind of, you know, those bad actors. And I hope that we don't, but I think everyone's ready, you know, to give them a swift kick out of town if we, you know, we run across them. So, but it's even the good players in town, you know, the client can't be expected to do all of that work, all of that due diligence, right? These are big teams, as you mentioned, and you know, to have a very experienced team kind of go out and do that due diligence for them, that's very, very valuable service that you guys provide.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, oftentimes when things like that happen, you know, we imagine, you know, the villain with a cape out there who's planning these nefarious things. Sometimes it's not so quote unquote evil. It can be that there's a general contractor that has a development project and they're commingling funds and they, you know, are misallocating things, and suddenly they're in a position where they have to declare bankruptcy, right? It's not always such a nefarious thing, but it's really just making sure that the people you're working with are tracking the project in a way that is fair and transparent, and that you're, you know, mitigating these kinds of risks that could happen.
For sure.
And sometimes that's just as simple as, hey, this team only has a single project manager. And while he may be great, if he gets sick or gets hit by a bus, as we say, you know, then what happens? Who takes this project over? So I think there's some amount of redundancy and resiliency even within the team composition is really important.
Yeah, without doubt, man. Well said. So, you know, a lot of your case studies highlight, you know, leveraging Peak's, you know, network of architects and contractors and other experts. In a rebuild situation, how critical is it to pick, you know, the right, I think we've almost kind of answered this already, but, you know, how critical is it to pick, you know, the right team of, you know, designers and builders?
Yeah, I mean, that is project success, right? One of the things that we look at a lot is, have you done similar projects to this in the past? Are you qualified? But also, what is your chemistry with the client, right? We need to make sure also that everyone is enjoying working with each other. People are spending a lot of money, and it has to be a fun process. If it's not fun for the client or for the project team, then when the client gets done with the project and moves into the house, you know, they're not going to enjoy that space nearly as much as if they had a really, really good time throughout it.
For sure. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think we all want to have fun on projects. They can't all be fun, but I think that's a reasonable goal to have, is let's all do some good work and have fun.
Sometimes we say that if we can make our project the most fun project, and all of the subcontractors, designers, general contractor wants to be working on that one, then you're going to get the best level of service from everyone, and the client is going to end up winning in the end. So Right. That's something that we really focus on.
Yeah, no, without
doubt. Especially, yeah, you know, when we're looking at things like the Palisades, where you've got so many concurrent projects, and a big part of it is, how do I get that plumber over to this job site to finish this work? Making sure that, you know, you're paying him on time, that his team is being treated well, that he's got the resources and he's set up to be successful. That's a big part of it.
Yeah. No, without, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, with regard to these different stakeholders that, that are going to be involved, you know, architects and, you know, contractors, et cetera, what are some of the qualities that you look for when kind of vetting and, you know, selecting members of your team for a project?
Yeah, great question. So there's qualitative factors and quantitative factors. So on the quantitative side, it's pretty easy, right? You can look at their insurance records. You can look at their fee percentages, overhead and profit. You can look at how they're setting things up with general conditions. That stuff is really easy to compare apples to apples, right? And so when we do an initial search for an architect or for a general contractor, we go out to, you know, some of our existing pool or perhaps recommendations from a client, and we show them A, B, C. You know, these are the different quantitative factors. This is how everyone stands. Then there's the qualitative side, right? And that can be a little bit harder to judge. Sometimes, again, that's setting up interviews with the client to make sure there's the right chemistry. Sometimes it's also asking questions about, hey, how did you deal with this challenge in the past? Show us a past project that's similar to what we're planning here. What kinds of risks are there on this project and how would you approach them? So I think it's really about more of an interview style and trying to get to the meat of, you know, the particular concerns on a project.
Yeah, for sure. Well, as it relates to a stakeholder's past, how do you uncover maybe a difficult time that they went through, or like a really bad project, or, you know, something that they might not want to talk about that you know happened, and you want to get, you know, you know, maybe one side of it, you want to get their side of it. They clearly don't want to necessarily talk about it, but you're really maybe interested in hiring that stakeholder, but there's this one thing that's kind of like, oh, it's a chink in the armor. How do you approach that kind of part of the stakeholder's history in a way that, you know, doesn't offend them or scare them away, but gets to the bit of the point that, that you really want to talk about?
That's such a great question. And, you know, at the end of the day, all of us in this industry have gone beat up at some point or another, right? If you haven't, then you haven't been doing it long
enough. Right. Yeah, exactly.
So sometimes I think I try to share a little bit about how I've been beaten up or losses that I've had so that they feel a little bit more comfortable in opening up as well. But I also am not afraid to be very upfront, transparent, and point blank about it. Hey, we heard this. I want to give you the opportunity to share your side of the story and tell us a little bit about how this happened and what you did to fix it. Because at the end of the day, if we've all gone through it, it's really not about like what happens when something gets screwed up. It's how you fix it and right. what you how, do to really yeah. repair the situation.
How do you respond?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Or if you respond.
You know, I will yeah. say that I'm in the position where most of my day is really only dealing with the most critical problems that come up on projects. And, you know, I really love solving problems. And that's what makes this job so much fun is no problems are the same. I've started to learn patterns and how to approach them, but the critical thinking that it takes to solve real challenges is, you know, what continuously keeps me inspired.
Yeah. Same here. I couldn't agree more. I love to solve problems and a new challenge is always, you know, cool. Let's go. Let's yeah. figure this out. So, you know, given all the upheaval, the grief and everything that we've gone through in LA over the last 6 months since the fire, what gives you hope in this, you know, overall effort to rebuild and, you know, just generally speaking, you know, about, you know, the Palisades component of the rebuild, because that's where the majority of our, you know, projects are clustered. What gives you hope in this, you know, wild time that we find ourselves in?
I mean, it's absolutely the community of design and construction professionals who've come together and tried to come up with really creative solutions here. I've never seen so much information sharing before. I've never seen so much collaboration between competitors. And we really are in a situation here where it's just how do we give back and how do we help? I know that my phone has been totally open to whoever wants to give me a call and ask questions and how I can, you know, be of service to the community. And I know a lot of other partners are doing the same. The reality is most of these projects are probably a little bit too small to bring in a project manager. But once you have the opportunity to help a few people and set them on the right track, they share information with their neighbors and it really elevates the game for everyone. So that's what we're looking to do. And it's just really amazing to see everyone come together in this way. And this is a testament for you guys to putting together a podcast really to help people access information and get trusted expertise from, you know, a group of people who are really incredible designers, contractors, owners, reps alike.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for saying that. And thanks for coming on the show today. I super appreciate your perspective. Is there anything else that you want to add? Any kind of like closing remark or, I mean, we covered a lot of ground, of course, but anything else that you want to leave with the audience as far as, you know, maybe resources that they could reach out to and access, or just any advice that you may want to give?
Yeah, I would say if you have any questions about Peak projects or how we can help set you up for success, feel free to shoot us an email, info@peakprojects.com, and we'll make sure that we get back to you with some helpful information.
Awesome. Thank you again very much, Aaron, for coming out, and we'll look forward to continuing to work with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.